The man, the highwayman. I saw his face, I know him.
Monty, Percy says from behind me.
I press on. I'm so sure of it and so desperate to finally be useful and write about something that I won't be interrupted. It's the Duke of Bourbon, the French King's Prime Minister. I met him at Versailles.
Monty,
Percy shifts to my side, his hand brushing my elbow. The box came from his apartments.
Monty,
what is it, Percy?
Take this.
He's trying to press his violin case into my hands.
Why?
Because I think I'm going to faint.
And then he does.
God bless Percy for the warning, but I'm not as quick on my feet as that. I haven't got a firm hold on the fiddle case when he collapses, and I sacrifice my grip on it to catch him before he hits the ground. It bounces along the boards, one of the latches popping open with a metallic ping. Catching him sends me to my knees and we sink down together, my arms under his and his face pressed into my chest. I expect him to be limp as cloth, but instead he's gone rigid. His body's twisted up and stiff, a contorted sculpture of himself, and it doesn't look like he's breathing. The muscles in his chest feel like they're pulled up too tight to let in any air, and I can hear his teeth squeak as they grind together.
Percy!
I lay him on the ground and shake him lightly.
Hey, Purse, come on, wake up.
I don't know why I'm talking to him. It feels like the only thing I can do. His back arches, veins in his neck straining against his skin, and I think maybe he's coming around. But then he starts to shake. Not just shake, convulse, frightening and out of control. His limbs look like they're trying to pull away from his body, head kicking at the planking. And I don't know what to do. I've never felt so stupid and helpless and afraid in my life.
Do something, I think, because my best friend is writhing on the ground in obvious pain, but I am absolutely stuck. I can't think of a thing to do to help him. I can't even move.
Suddenly Felicity is kneeling beside me.
Get out of the way, she snaps,
and I come back to myself enough to follow orders. She takes my place, grabbing two fistfuls of Percy's coat and hauling him onto his side so there's less chance of him slamming into one of the tent stakes as he convulses.
Percy,
she says, leaning over him.
Percy, can you hear me?
He doesn't respond. I'm not sure if he'd be able to, even if he heard. Felicity puts one hand on his shoulder, like she's keeping him steady on his side, and kicks the fiddle case out of his way. Then she sits back and does nothing but hold him in that place.
What are you doing?
I cry. I've got my hands pressed to either side of my face, a farcical gesture of horror.
We've got to help him!
There's nothing to be done, she replies. And she sounds so calm, it feeds my panic.
He needs help!
It should be over in a minute. We have to wait.
You can't!
I start to crawl forward without any plan of what I'm about to do. But Felicity whips around and skewers me with a glare.
Unless you know what you're talking about, please stay out of the way and keep quiet.
I can't watch it. I can't watch Felicity being so calm, and Percy's body wrenching and distorted, and me sitting on the ground feeling so goddamn helpless. It seems like it lasts forever, as though we've spent days here waiting, spectators to what I'm certain is Percy dying slowly in intense agony. His breathing sounds labored and gravelly, and his lips are tinged faintly blue. When Felicity tips him farther on his side, spittle, pinked with blood, froths at the corner of his mouth. He's coming out of it, she says quietly. She has one hand hovering near the back of his head as a cushion between his arched neck and the iron tent stakes. Percy's body gives a final pull, knees coiling up to his chest. Then he vomits. Felicity keeps a good hold on him so that when his muscles loosen, he stays on his side. His eyes are still closed.
Wake up, Purse,
I think. Come on, wake up and be alive and be all right. Please be all right. We need to get him somewhere close by, Felicity says, brushing his hair away from where it's stuck to his lips with a soft touch. That's either too subtle or I'm not thinking straight, because she looks over at me and snaps,
If you want to help, now would be the time for that.
I stagger to my feet, so shaky I nearly keel straight back over and stumble down the path between the tents. I don't know where to go. There's nothing nearby but the fair stands, and the highwaymen are probably still prowling, searching for us. I look down into the slat of sea visible between the planks, just as an orange bobs past, its rind slick and glittering with beads of seawater. I sprint back the way I went before, shouldering through the crowds, all stopped and staring up at the fireworks, until I find the apothecary's stand again. He stepped out from under its awning and is watching the show too, but he turns when he sees me coming. You return? My friend needs help, I blurt.
I'm sorry to hear that. Can you help him?
In what way?
You're a doctor.
I'm an apothecary. But you know, you can... I'm so winded I can hardly get words out. My chest feels corked. Please, I don't know what's wrong with him. The apothecary is sizing me up, all the mirth gone from his face.
I think you're trouble.
We're not trouble, we're in trouble, I say. We're travellers and we've nowhere to go and he needs help and... Please, he's had some kind of fit and he was shaking and he won't wake and I don't know what's wrong. Please. My voice gets properly pitchy on that last bit, which must make me sound sufficiently pathetic, or at least sincere, for he takes me by the elbow and says, "Show me where he is." I nearly throw my arms around him for that. I want to run, but the apothecary seems insistent on a brisk walk, and I'm forced to match it or else lose him in the crowd. As we clamber through the people with their faces turned to the sky, he asks me to recount what happened, and I give him a tongue-tied version that brings the panic in me back up to a boil. I'm such a wreck I can hardly remember where I've come from. All the tents look the same. I'm about to tell him I'm afraid I won't be able to find Percy and Felicity again when I spot her silhouette, black against the brackish canvas. "Here," I say, and I lead him between the tents. Another firework pops over our heads. Percy's still insensible, but he's starting to stir. Felicity's kneeling over him, one of his hands in hers, speaking to him, though he doesn't seem to hear. A watery ribbon of blood and spittle slips from the corner of his mouth and down his cheek. Felicity pulls her sleeve over her thumb and wipes it away. She looks up as we approach, casting a wary eye at the stranger. "He's an apothecary," I explain. "He can help." The apothecary doesn't say a word to Felicity as she shuffles out of his way and he adopts her place, taking Percy's face in his hands and peering at it, then checking his pulse, then his eyes and inside his mouth. He, too, swipes his thumb at the blood. "He's bleeding," I murmur, not realizing I've spoken aloud, until Felicity replies, "He bit his tongue, that's all." The apothecary takes a waxed envelope of smelling salts from the pocket of his coat and slips his finger under the flap, all the while speaking to Percy in the language I don't recognize. His voice is very gentle. "Obre els uls, has passat una nit difficile veritat, em pots mirar, miram. Look at me." Percy opens his eyes, and I let go a sigh of relief, even though it seems to take him a tremendous effort. His gaze is a long way off from us. "Molt bé, molt bé," the apothecary murmurs. "Do you know where you are?" Percy blinks twice, slowly, then his eyes slide closed again and his head tips sideways. The apothecary catches it before his face smacks the ground. "He needs rest." "We'd nowhere to go," Felicity replies. "I have a boat moored in the canal where you may bring him. I'll see what more can be done for him there." I nod, waiting for someone to do something useful, until Felicity snaps at me. "He's not going to walk it off, Monty. You have to carry him." "Oh, right." The apothecary slides out of the way and I hoist Percy over my shoulder. My feet stumble for purchase on the ground, and I almost fall, but Felicity pushes me straight, and we follow the apothecary between the tents. Beyond the pier, our guide leads us, sure-footed, down a thin, sandy path, past the sailing ships and along the riverbank, until we reach a tar-caked dock, where a fleet of brightly painted canal boats are moored, neat as harpsichord keys. My arms are starting to shake. My whole body feels like it's shaking inside and out. The apothecary jumps aboard one of the boats, taking up a lantern from the prow before he grabs me by the arm and hauls me after him. Felicity follows with a light step. The canal boat has a narrow deck with a covered cabin in the center, and I follow him into it. It's a trick maneuvering both Percy and I through the small door without knocking either of us out cold, and once we're inside, my head nearly brushes the ceiling. The apothecary leads me to a built-in box bed covered in pieced quilts and a handful of thin pillows. Hanging earthenware lanterns decorate the walls in diamond shards of light that bob and sway as the boat bounces in the water. "Here," The apothecary pulls back the blankets on the bed, and I ease Percy down onto it. I didn't realize he had woken, but he grabs onto me like he thinks he's falling. Monty?
Right here, Percy.
I'm trying to keep the shudder out of my voice and failing. I'm right here, it's... I've got no clue what I'm supposed to say.
It's all right.
God, I sound so daft.
It's bright, he murmurs.
His voice is muzzy and slurred. He hardly sounds like himself, and his eyes still aren't focused. Seems he's having a hard time keeping them open at all. He keeps squinting like he's looking into the sun. His hands are clamped around my coat, so tight his knuckles are blotched. And when I sit him upon the bed, he clutches me tighter, his voice pitching.
Don't leave me!
I won't. He seems so distressed that I don't want to peel him off, so I stoop there, my hands around his, trying to convince him to lie down, with my voice shaking. His shoulders slump suddenly, head falling forward against my chest, and I think he's going to let me go, but then his fingers go tight and he tries to stand again.
I need my violin. Where is it? Where's my violin? I need it now.
I've got it, Percy. Felicity appears at my side, prying Percy's fingers off my coat and guiding him down onto the bed.
Try to relax. It's all right. You're safe now. Relax.
On the other side of the cabin, the apothecary pulls a medicine chest from a shelf and begins rummaging through its drawers, bottles clinking together in a soft chorus from inside. I can tell that I'm useless, so I slink backward onto the deck and into the cool night air. Above the water, the stars are spread in smudgy handfuls across the twilight. I can still hear the music of the fair, and closer by a slow tune plucked out upon a mandolin, one lonely string at a time. On the bank, crickets are purring. I sit down with my back to the railing, turning my face to the sky and letting the shaky fatigue settle through me. Turns out panic is rather exhausting, and I fall asleep without meaning to, my head tipped back against the railing of the boat, before anyone has come out. 9. It feels like I've hardly closed my eyes when Felicity is shaking me awake. Sunrise is a spilled glass of wine across the horizon, stars fading back into imaginary things. Someone put a blanket over me while I slept, and my knees are aching after so long folded up to my chest. In spite of the night we've had, Felicity looks very awake. Her eyes are wide and alert, and she's undone the pins from her hair and woven it into a plait that swings over her shoulder as she leans toward me. I, in contrast, feel like a washed-up carcass of myself. My eyes are crusty, and a thin line of spittle has run down my chin while I slept. I swipe it away. I haven't shaved in a week, and I'm starting to get fuzzy.
"Are you well?" Felicity asks.
"What, me?"
"Yes. How's Percy?"
She looks down at the deck, and my heart seizes up. "Sore and weary. He's trying to rest, but he's been too agitated to stay asleep for long. He's going to be fine," she adds, for I must look stricken.
"Only a matter of time."
"Sorry, I should have stayed up with him, with you.
You were tired, and there wasn't much to be done. Pascal bled him, and he took some mugwort, so we'll see if that has any effect."
"Pascal?"
"The apothecary, the man you found."
"Does he know what's wrong with Percy?"
Felicity slides to her knees in front of me, one hand on the rail. "I think you best speak to Percy."
"What do I need to speak to him about?" I ask, dread creeping around me and tightening like a noose.
"He's got something to tell you, and I don't want to be the go-between."
"Oh, right. Well, I should probably go speak to Percy then," I say like it was my idea, and pull myself up. Felicity doesn't reply. She takes my spot on the deck as I descend the few steps into the belly of the boat. The cabin is still dark, but they've lit a few more lanterns, and the shadows sway as the current rocks us. It feels like being drunk, a little tipsy and unsteady, but with none of the warm, comfortable buzz. The air smells of incense and seawater, and there's a cup of tea resting on the floor beside the bed, steam rising from the surface, and threading its fingers with dust motes drifting through the pale light. Percy is curled up in the corner of the box bed, stripped down to only rumpled breeches and a clean shirt, the translucent material clinging to his skin with sweat. There's a violet bruise beneath his eye like a crack in a glass window pane, and a thread of bandage tied off in the crook of one elbow. A small blush of blood has seeped through it. He looks more tired than I've ever seen him. His hair is undone from its queue, and it falls in long coils around his face. I ease myself down on the opposite corner of the bed, one leg pulled up under me, and Percy opens his eyes. "Morning," I say quietly. Percy doesn't reply. The sound of the sea kicking against the side of the boat fills the silence. I'm swallowing the urge to say something daft because I hate this taut band between us. It feels like the walls are closing in. Say something, Monty. Be a friend. Be a gentleman. Be a human being. It's Percy, your best friend. Percy who you've gotten foxed with, who plays you his violin, who used to spit apple seeds at you from high up in the orchard treetops. Percy who you kissed in Paris, who looks so damn beautiful even now. Say something kind, something that will make him stop looking so alone and afraid. But I can't come up with a damn thing. All I want to do is dash out of reach of whatever it is he's about to say. Percy presses his forehead to the wall. "I'm sorry," he murmurs. His voice has a drowsy tint to it.
"For what?"
"For what happened."
"It wasn't your fault, Percy. You couldn't have done..."
"It's epilepsy," he says. And I stop.
"What?"
"Epilepsy," he repeats, then covers his face with his hand so it comes out muffled when he says it again.
"I have epilepsy."
I don't know what to say to that, so I blurt, "Well, so long as that's all it is." I hope it might make him laugh, but instead he lets out a tense sigh through his teeth. "Can you please not be yourself right now?" I look down at the bed, my hands worrying the worn stitching of the blanket.
"So you're ill?"
"Yes."
"Epilepsy?"
"Yes." I know almost nothing about epilepsy. Devils and possession and insanity, those are the sorts of things I've heard of, but they're the stuff of horror stories that end with the moral, "Thank God each day for your health." And besides, this is Percy, the best lad I know. None of those things can be right. And there isn't... I halt, and I swear I'm so rotten at this that even the silence winces. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to ask and what I shouldn't, and what questions I'm comfortable hearing the answers to. Is it contagious? Does it hurt? When will you be well again? Are you going to die? Are you going to die? Are you going to die? I wish we could go back to the moment before he told me, and I could just keep not knowing.
"Is there a cure? Or treatment? Or anything?"
"No, no cure. None of the treatments have worked."
"Oh, well, that's too bad."
His mouth pulls tight like he's going to say something to correct me, but then he just nods, and I want to turn to sand and slip between the boards.
"So you have these
fits?"
"Yes, all right, yes, that."
"You can say it." "I really don't think I can."
How long has this been happening?"
"Every few months."
"No, I mean, when did it start?"
Percy is still turned to the wall, and before he answers, he twists even farther from me. His face is almost out of sight. "Right before you came home from Eton."
"Eton?"
I gape at him.
"Percy, that was 2 years ago. You've been ill for 2 years, and you've never said anything to me about it."
"No one knows, all right? Only my family and some of our staff."
"When were you going to tell me?"
"I was sort of hoping I'd never have to. I've been lucky so far."
"Lucky?"
I've shifted from meek to spitting with fury on the other side of a second.
"You kept this secret from me for 2 years, Percy. 2 goddamn years. How could you not tell me?"
At last he raises his head. "Are you really trying to make this about you?"
"I want to know."
"I'm telling you now, aren't I?"
"Yes, because you have to, because I had to watch."
"Well, I'm sorry you had to watch." The venom rises in his voice suddenly. "How hard for you to have to watch.
Why didn't you tell me?"
He clenches his hands into fists around the blankets, face set, then says, "Fine, you want to know why? Because at the end of this year, I'm not going to law school, I'm going into an asylum." We stare at each other. It takes a long moment for me to grasp what he said.
It's so horrid and utterly unbelievable that I'm certain I must have heard wrong. You're... what?
There's a place in Holland, a sanatorium for the... He squeezes his eyes tight and finishes very carefully. For the insane.
I don't know what to say. I've heard stories of bedlam in London. Black, poisonous rumours no one speaks of in polite company. Asylums aren't hospitals or spas. They aren't somewhere you go to get well. They're somewhere you go after everything else has been tried. Somewhere you're hidden away and forgotten, bound to your bed and starved and emptied of your blood. There's somewhere you go to die. If Percy goes into a sanatorium, he'll never come home. We won't see each other again. My chest is so tight I can hardly get words out.
But you're not insane, is all I manage to say.
Perhaps I am. This isn't ordinary, is it? He tips his chin, staring down with his cheeks sucked in.
Is that what you want? Go to Holland and die in a madhouse?
He winces a bit, and I wish at once I hadn't spoken so bluntly, but I don't retreat from it.
Of course not.
Is this your uncle, then? Is it his idea to send you away? I'm starting to speak so fast I can hardly understand myself, grasping frantically at any thread of a way to fix this. You can't, I'm thinking. You can't be ill because I need you, and you can't go away to die in some asylum, because what am I supposed to do without you?
You have to tell them no. Tell them you won't. You can't go. Just tell them you won't.
I haven't got a choice. My family won't care for me any longer.
Then go somewhere else. Anywhere.
How? He snaps.
And how could you possibly understand any of this? If anyone found out, my whole family would suffer for it, and I'm not going to weigh them down any more than I already have.
He's kneading the blanket against his legs, veins in his hands standing out like bright threads beneath his skin.
My aunt thinks that this is God's way of punishing me. The family's bastard Negro boy has convulsive fits. It's appropriate. She still won't be disabused of the notion that I'm possessed by the devil, and my uncle keeps telling me that I need to stop being hysterical and overcome it.
He tips his head backward, and when the lantern light catches his eyes, I realize he's crying. Or rather, he's trying very hard not to cry, which is even worse. I don't have a clue of what to do. I feel like a loon for sitting still and not doing anything to comfort him, but my limbs hardly feel as though they belong to me. I can't remember how to touch him. Percy keeps talking, his face skyward.
My little cousin still won't sit near me because he thinks it's catching. He's got to be coaxed into being in the same room. It took a year to find a valet who was willing to stay on after he knew he'd have to serve a dark-skinned boy who had convulsions without warning. I have been cupped by savage barbers, and exercised, and blessed, and I haven't eaten meat in a year and a bloody half, and it's not going away, so I have to. Monty, are you listening to me?
I am, but I'm not hearing it, or it's not going through my brain. I'm hearing without understanding a word. This feels like a nightmare, a dream of being buried alive that I thrash against but can't wake from. And everything he says is another spadeful of dirt pressing down on my chest. All this pain in him I've never noticed.
Monty!
Yes, I say faintly. Yes, I'm listening. He takes a long breath, one hand pressed to his forehead.
So let's find Lockwood and see if we can convince him to let us keep traveling. We'll see the continent and have all the good times we planned, and then I'll go to Holland and...
I stand up so fast my foot catches on the blanket and I stumble.
No, no, just stop, Percy, stop.
He looks up at me, his mouth tight to stop the trembling. I feel like crying too, feel like falling down into the bed next to him and sobbing. I'm shaking and dizzy, emotion distilled into physical symptoms, and all I manage to say is,
why didn't you tell me? Because you're a wreck, complete shambles. I've spent years chasing you around, making certain you didn't drink yourself to death, or pass out in a gutter, or slit your own wrists.
I'm right there on the edge of tears. I can feel them round and hot and clogging my throat, but I am not going to cry.
And I know you've had a rough go, with your father and being thrown out of school, but you've not been yourself. Not for a while. And I couldn't have you making this worse.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't. Another spade of earth hits me. But you didn't even give me a chance, I say. My voice comes out very, very small. I thought we told each other everything. This isn't about us. It's always going to be about us. No, you want this to be about you. You care about what happens to me because of what that would mean for you. You are the only thing that matters to you. I can't think of anything to say, so I settle for the second best thing to a witty retort and storm out. But even that gets botched when the boat suddenly tips and I'm pitched into the wall. I straighten myself out, stomp to the door, and don't look back. 10. Felicity is still on the deck when I return, her chin to her chest and her eyes closed, but she looks up as I slump beside her. If she were Percy, I'd bury my head in her shoulder and moan. But she's not. She's Felicity, and the only person I want to talk to about my fight with Percy is Percy. Which just seems unfair. So, what did you two talk about? Felicity asks lightly. Percy's ill. Yes. Epilepsy. He told me. When? 2 years ago when he first found out? No, about an hour ago before you woke up. I mash my fingers into my forehead. I'm not certain if he told her about the sanatorium, and I'm afraid that giving voice to it is going to make it feel even more sickening and real than it already does. So I say, he's not possessed. No, he's not, she says, and the firmness in her voice surprises me, and his doctors are backward quacks if any of them told him so. If they've been keeping up with any recent research, they should know it's been proven that epilepsy is nothing to do with demonic possession. That's all Dark Ages nonsense. So what causes it? The Boer Harvest School published a pamphlet. The what? Never mind. No, tell me. That thing you said, the school thing, what does it say? She lets out a little sigh through her nose. It simply claims that there are many reasons someone might develop epilepsy, but no one truly understands any of them. It's all speculation. Can it be cured? Because if there's a cure, if there is anything that could possibly make him well, he won't be sent to Holland, and I won't lose him. But Felicity shakes her head, and my lifeline slips out to sea. I press my face into my knees. The first rays of the sun are starting to creep across the back of my neck. It's maddening that the world is so quiet and still and completely unchanged from the moment before I stepped into the cabin of the boat. Percy's ill. It's seeping through me like a poison, leaving me jumbled up and numb. Percy's ill and will never be well again, and is being sent away to die in a sanatorium because of it. And close on its heels, a second thought that leaves me nearly as cold. Percy didn't trust me enough to tell me so. Felicity, am I a good person? She looks sideways at me, one eyebrow ascending. Why, are you having some sort of crisis? No, yes. I scrub my fingers through my hair. Percy didn't tell me. I know, that wasn't very good of him, but I sort of understand it. Why? What's so wrong with me that you both seem to think I couldn't handle knowing? Well, you're a bit of a rake. Thanks for that. You can't behave the way you do and then be surprised when someone tells you so. She massages her temples with the tips of her fingers, her mouth pulling into a frown. I do not pretend to understand the passionate friendship you and Percy have always sustained. You're important to each other, there's no questioning that. But I don't think you can blame him for not telling you. Your attention is usually elsewhere, and when hard things come up, you drink, you sleep around, you run away. I want to run away right then, but there's just Percy in the cabin and water on either side, and the person I most want to run away from is me. Instead, I say, I'm glad you were there for Percy. If it had been just me, he probably would have died. He wouldn't have died. You seem to be underestimating my incompetence. Epileptic fits aren't fatal unless some outside force comes into play. If he'd struck his head or fallen into the sea, please stop, I say. And she lapses into silence.
I muss my fingers through my hair again. For the first time in a long while, I feel compelled to do something about someone's pain besides my own. But the press is blunted by knowing there's not a damn thing to be done for him. Nor can I undo these past 2 years. He's had no one, not even his family, on his side for this. I'd always thought it was Percy and me against the world. But the truth was, I marooned him long ago and never realized it. How did you know what was happening to him? I ask. She shrugs. I didn't, but I had a guess. And about that school you were talking about. The Boer Harbor School? It's not a literal school, it's a school of scientific thought. I've read about it some. I thought you read... What exactly is in those books of yours? She crosses her arms and blows a tight sigh through her nose. If I tell you something, you can't mock me for it. And I don't only mean now, you can't whip this out and mock me for it at some later date when you're feeling peevish. I'm not going to mock you. She takes another huffy breath, nostrils flaring, then says, I've been studying medicine. Medicine? Since when have you been interested in that? Since my whole life. Where do you learn about medicine? I read. I've been stripping the covers off amatory novels and swapping them with medical textbooks for years so Father wouldn't find out. He'd rather I read those trampy Eliza Haywoods than study almanacs on surgery and anatomy. I burst out laughing. Felly, you glorious little shit. That's the most devious thing I've ever heard. She laughs too, and I remember suddenly we've got matching sets of dimples. It's so rare that I see Felicity smile, I'd forgotten we both inherited them from our father. I'd rather study medicine than go to finishing school. That's what I wanted. But they don't let girls into universities. Girls go to finishing schools and boys go to medical school. Not me. I'm supposed to run the estate. I laugh like it isn't excruciating to be the punchline of your own joke, but Felicity's face softens. I didn't know Father was so rough on you. Every father is rough on his sons. I'm not the only one. Doesn't make it easier. I survived it, didn't I? Did you? She touches her forehead lightly to my shoulder, then sits up straight again. What are you smiling at? Nothing, I say, though said smile breaks into a sudden laugh. Only I think it's quite amusing that our respectable parents raise two contrary children. Felicity grins at me in return, and then she laughs as well, a loud and distinctly unladylike sound, and I love it all the more for that. Two contrary children, she repeats. Our new little brother doesn't have a chance. Pascal finds Felicity and me for breakfast, a blissfully full and not thieved meal, satisfying in spite of the fact that it contains a fair amount more rice and beans than I'm generally inclined to. We eat crouched on the deck of the canal boat around a smoking iron stove, tin plates cupped between our hands, and no utensils but bread. The fair, Pascal tells us, is a travelling one. The merchants load their tents into boats and float up and down the Rhone, stopping in towns they come to and mixing with the local tradesmen until they've recruited enough to set up stalls. As the dawn breaks, muddy and pink across the water, women spread laundry along the rails and jump between the decks to speak to each other. Children run along the banks. Men play cards and smoke pipes, the gauzy threads that rise from their lips mingling with the early morning mist off the water. They seem complete unto themselves, a small floating kingdom along the fringes of the sea, and remarkably ordinary to themselves. Perhaps this is what the Grand Tour is meant to do. Show me the way other people live, in lives that are not like my own. It's a strange feeling, realizing that other people you don't know have their own full lives that don't touch yours. I try to watch without staring until Felicity kicks me. You needn't look at them like they're on display. I'm interested. You're gawking. Monty, we're guests. Pascal slides a piece of bread around the rim of his plate, two fingers propping the crust. You should take some food to Mr. Newton. I don't think he'll eat, Felicity replies. I tried earlier, but he couldn't keep anything down. Pascal chews for a moment, looking to the cabin where Percy's lying, then says, "Where is it you come from?"
"England," I reply. "We're touring."
"You seem to be running."
"Well, that's what we're currently doing, but we were once touring."
"The men you were running from, are they traveling with you?"
"No, they attacked us on the road from Paris. We think they're looking for..."
I glance at Felicity. She gives me a little shrug as if to say why not. I pull the puzzle box out of my pocket and hand it to Pascal.
"We think they're after this."
He turns it over in his hands, spinning the dials a few times. "A box?"
"That's the extent of what we know about it."
"Why did they want it?"
"We don't know," Felicity says, "and we're afraid if we hand it over we'll be killed for taking it."
"Ah, so you stole it."
"Yes, but not from them."
Then I remember the highwayman was the Duke from Versailles, in whose apartments I was caught with a bare-breasted French girl.
Perhaps sort of from them.
"It looks quite old."
He hands the puzzle box back to me and I stash it in my coat.
"There are two women who travel in our company who made their living in antiques. They deal mostly in trinkets now, little things that sell at carnivals, but they may know something about it if you let me show them."
I look over at Felicity like we might consult on this, but she says, "Yes, absolutely. If they could tell us anything, that would be so appreciated."
"They may be at the fair already. I'll see if I can fetch them. Stay here."
As Pascal picks his way across the desk, I murmur to Felicity, "Do you think this is a good idea?"
"I think I'd like to know why we're being hunted," she says, "and what we can do to stop it."
She pokes at the pocket of my coat, harboring the puzzle box.
"This is your fault, Henry. At least try to fix things."
I would like very much to punch her in the nose for saying that, even though she's right. Pascal returns half an hour later with a woman on each arm, both old and bent and dressed head to toe in black, complete with thick veils like they're in mourning. He climbs onto the boat first, then helps them each across. Felicity and I both stand.
"Señorites Ernesta Herrera," he inclines toward the taller of the two, "y Eva Davila. They are the grandmothers to our company, les nostres aviés."
He smiles fondly at the two when he says it.
"I told them about your situation and they believe they might be able to help."
I start to pull the puzzle box out of my pocket, but the taller woman's hand, Ernesta's, shoots out much faster than her pace led me to believe it was capable of, and closes around my wrist.
"Not here,"
she hisses in accented French.
"Why not here?" "If people are after it," she says, "do not wave it around."
We follow the grandmothers into the cabin of the boat. Ernesta laughs softly when she sees Percy in bed and says over her shoulder to Pascal,
"You have a menagerie of these unfortunates, mijo."
As we shuffle in, I try to look anywhere but at Percy. But that's a bit of a trick in a room that's barely 8 foot square. I do manage to only do it out of the corner of my eye, not straight on, which is a bit coyer and conveys that I'm still mad as hell at him. He looks well pathetic, curled up on his side, face turned to the pillow as pale sunlight wafts through the cabin door. His hair is matted on one side where he's been lying on it, and his skin looks slick and waxy. But I refuse to be moved. Pascal stays out on deck, while Ernesta and Eva settle themselves on cushions tossed across the floor. Felicity perches on the end of the box bed and says something to Percy, too quietly for me to hear. He shakes his head, face turned away from hers. There's nowhere else to sit unless I want to cuddle up with Percy, so I stand, sort of awkwardly, in the center of it all, trying to get my sea legs and not knock my head on the hanging lamps.
"Could we perhaps speak elsewhere?" Felicity says,
but Percy opens his eyes and pushes himself up on an elbow. The neck of his shirt slips down over his shoulder, revealing the sharp course of his collarbone.
"No, I want to hear this."
Ernesta holds out a hand to me.
"Let us see."
I surrender the puzzle box. She turns it over in her hands, then passes it to Eva.
"You have stolen this?"
Felicity and Percy both look at me, and there's no point denying it, so I nod.
You must return it.
The men I took it from are trying to kill us, I say.
Not to them, she waves a hand. It does not belong to them.
How do you know?
This is a Bessagio puzzle box. They are expensive and rare, and they are not used to hold things of worldly value like money or jewelry or the wants of common thieves.
She spins one of the dials with the tip of her finger. It makes a soft ticking sound, like a clock winding.
These boxes were designed to carry alchemical compounds over long distances and keep them safe if stolen.
Ava taps the end of the box and says something in a language I don't understand. Ernesta translates.
The name of the owner is carved here on the rim.
She holds it up and points to the thin band of enameling along the hinge, inscribed with gold letters that I hadn't noticed before.
Professor Mateu Robles.
I know him, Felicity says. Then she adds when we all look at her, not personally, I attended a lecture on his work in Paris. He studies panaceas. What's a panacea? Percy asks. A cure-all, Felicity explains. An item or a compound that is a remedy for multiple ailments, like a bezoa or ginseng.
Robles is well known in Spain, Ernesta says. One of the last great alchemists in the court before the crown changed hands, though of late better known for killing his wife.
Felicity lets out a small squeak at that.
He killed his wife? Percy says hoarsely.
An experiment gone wrong, Ernesta says. An accident, but she died by his hand all the same.
But the box didn't come from Mateu Robles, I say. I stole it from the King of France.
You stole it from the Duke of Bourbon, Felicity corrects, though the detail seems a bit irrelevant.
I think she just enjoys rubbing it in that I'm a thief. He's the one who's after us. What's in it? Percy asks. He's sitting up now, arms folded around his knees and leaning forward for a better look, like the box has changed since last he held it.
Something with alchemical properties, most likely, which makes it valuable, Ernesta replies. Or dangerous. Or both.
She shakes the box lightly beside her ear, like it might announce its own name.
Not a compound, though. It sounds to be a single item.
Couldn't someone break the box open? Felicity asks. It doesn't look very sturdy.
The boxes are often lined with vials of acid or some other corrosive substance. If the box is broken, the object inside is destroyed.
Ava says something and Ernesta nods.
She says that it must be returned to its owner.
And then they both look at me. By who? I ask. Us?
You are the thieves.
Monty's the thief, Felicity says. No, I'm the second thief, which I think cancels out my thievery.
This box carries cargo likely more precious than you can imagine. It must be returned to Mateu Robles.
Then you take it. You know more about it than we do. Ernesta shakes her head.
We have been expelled from Spain. We indulge in practices outlawed by the crown, and we cannot return without consequences.
You're Spanish? I can feel Felicity resisting the urge to roll her eyes. She's practically vibrating with the effort. Ernesta, for her part, does not roll her eyes at me.
We are Catalonian, she says.
I'm not sure of the distinction, but for fear of outright mockery from my sister, I move forward like that makes sense. And you think this professor is in Spain?
The Robleses are an old Catalonian family. They were in the court at the same time as we were, but they were expelled when the House of Bourbon won the throne and they returned to Barcelona.
And you want us to take it to them there? I ask. Absolutely not, Felicity interrupts, shaking her head so vehemently her plait whips the bedpost behind her.
I'm sorry, but we can't. We need to find our company and see that this is returned to the King of France.
It doesn't belong to him, Ernesta says. It must be returned to the professor alone. No one but him.
But surely there's a reason the king had it, Felicity argues. And we can't travel. We've no money, and our cicerone is waiting for us here, and Percy's been taken ill. We can't go anywhere if he's unwell.
Percy stares down at the quilts, tugging at a loose thread between the patches, and for a moment I think he'll protest, but he keeps silent. Felicity opens her mouth like she's got more reasons we can't ferry our chemical compounds south queued up, but she's interrupted by a sharp rap at the cabin door, followed by Pascal flinging it open. He's flush-faced and breathing hard like he's been running.
"Soldiers," he pants. "Marco ran down, they tore apart the fair, and they're headed this way."
My heartbeat stutters. It's rather clear who in this room they're after. The thought occurs to me that if they are the king's men, and if they are truly after us, and if they are being led by the duke, this might all be resolved by giving them the box. Though there seems to be equal odds they'll slit our throats and drop our bodies in the sea, and I'm not risking that. But more than that, alchemy and panaceas and cure-alls are knocking around in my mind. If there's anyone who can help Percy, perhaps even keep him from the asylum, it may be this family and their mad little box. And I'm not handing that over. "We can't give it to them," I blurt out. Felicity and Percy both look at me. So do the grandmothers, Ernesto wearing an expression that conveys this was such an obvious statement it's redundant. "They might kill us for stealing it," I say quickly. "And if it doesn't belong to the king and it contains something that could be dangerous in the wrong hands, I think we should wait."
"We'll hide you," Pascal says.
Outside the cabin, I can hear the guard's boots slapping the dock. "Come out now," a familiar voice yells. The Duke is definitely here.
"All of you, empty the boats."
"I think Monty's right," Percy says. "We don't give them the box." I turn to Felicity, who looks as though she thoroughly disagrees, but throws up her hands in surrender. "Fine!" Neither Ernesta nor Ava seems particularly troubled by the hordes of soldiers boarding the boat. Which is good, because I'm short on a plan but have an abundance of panic. 11. The King's Guard boards our boat. I can hear their shouted instructions through the walls, and the floor pitches each time one of them climbs aboard. Pascal is out on the deck attempting reason, but it doesn't sound like they're particularly keen on hearing it. The word fugitives gets tossed around a few times, and harbouring, which I have a strong sense is not in reference to the boats. I pray they'll bypass the cabin altogether and we won't have to test our disguise, but then I hear the stairs creak, and a moment later the door is tossed open.
"You were instructed to disembark."
The Duke of Bourbon strides in, decked in livery of the King's Guard, with a rapier at his side that looks like it could do a fair amount of damage if swung about. He's distinctly more ruffled-looking than he was when I saw him at the palace, his nose burnt by days in the sun, and his head unwigged. His hair is a short, coarse grey that curls in the back.
"Apologies, gentlemen," Pascal darts through the soldiers to Bourbon's side, "but these women are not permitted to go onto the deck."
Zounds, it is beastly hot under this veil. The air is smoky with the incense Ernesto lit, making it hard to see and harder to breathe. And the clothes we stripped off the bed were not meant to double as skirts. The fabric is slick, and I've got one hand on my back like I'm a hunched-over old woman, when really I'm just trying to keep the damn rug swathed around my waist from becoming both indecent and incriminating.
"Why?"
Bourbon taps his foot in the direction of Felicity, who's wrapped up in what a few moments ago was a wall hanging, and has a cushion cover over her head like a veil.
"Woman, show us your face."
"They cannot, senor," Pascal says.
"We will hear no protestations," Bourbon snaps. "She will show me her face, or be made to. They all will."
"They cannot because they are poxed," Pascal cries.
Bourbon, who had been reaching for the edge of the cushion cover currently doubling as Felicity's veil, draws back.
"Boxed?"
Beside me, Percy, similarly swathed in bed trimmings, sways on his feet, though I'm not certain if he's play-acting or sincerely faint. I want to reach out to him, but I'm afraid of drawing the Duke's eye and exposing my distinctly mannish and unpoxed hands.
"A strain from the Portuguese seas," Pascal goes on. "We have quarantined them for the safety of the city. So long as they keep their faces covered and the scabs unexposed, there is no danger."
Percy's definitely falling. He reaches out for me, and I grab him, trying to keep him on his feet. The swaddling over my head starts to slip. The Duke turns in our direction, but on the other side of the cabin, Ernesta lets out a high-pitched wail, and he whirls around. She seems to be really going for the theatrics, for she falls to her knees before Bourbon and clutches his boots, which successfully diverts his attention from Percy's sincere collapse. Ava follows her lead, face pressed to the ground as she pleads to him in keening Catalan. Bourbon shakes them off, then signals to his men. They're tripping over themselves in their haste to get back into the open air. In the doorway, we hear him say to Pascal, "You Spaniards are to be cleared out of here by tomorrow morning, or you'll be arrested. We will not have you cluttering up the river with your filth. And if we find you're hiding these criminals, the punishment will be severe." Pascal bows his head. "Yes, sir, we want no trouble." As soon as they're gone, Felicity is at Percy's other elbow, and together we help him to the bed. He sits down hard on the bare mattress, then slumps onto his side and pulls his legs up to his chest. "Are you well?" Felicity asks. Then asks again, when he doesn't respond. And for a cold, clenched-up moment, I think he's going to have another fit, and I almost take a step back. I'm not certain I'm stout enough to witness it again. But he's nodding, though he's breathing hard. "Yes, yes, just faint." I'm ready to strip this damn dress off as soon as the king's men have gone, but no one else moves to do the same, so I suffer and sweat a while longer. When Pascal returns to tell us the soldiers have gone, I whip the veil off my face and take a gasping breath that's mostly incense and immediately start to cough. Felicity slides off her headpiece and crumples it between her hands, shoulders quavering. "I'm so sorry," she's saying to Pascal. "I'm so sorry, you're fair, your whole company, because of us. We're so sorry." And Pascal is trying to reassure her, though he looks pained. Someone puts a hand on my arm, and I look around to find Ava standing beside me.
"Vosaltres passeu la nit amb nosaltres. Nosaltres farem la nostra permati." "You stay the night with us," Ernesta translates. "We go our own ways in the morning."
The grandmothers and Pascal go with some of the others from their company to clean up the mess of the fair. Felicity offers to help, but they decline in case any of Bourbon's men spot us. It hadn't occurred to me to ask. They return at dusk and we have supper on the boat, the five of us on the deck, while Percy sleeps in the cabin. He's still ill and unsteady, and I'm starting to wonder how we're going to move on if he can't stand straight. Maybe we should stay in Marseille and find Lockwood and forget all this nonsense after all. Some people from the other boats come join us, and we eat gathered around the iron stove at the prow. The lantern light, pebbled throughout the line of canal boats, glitters on the water, reflections the color of a daffodil cone bobbing amid the waves. After supper, Felicity excuses herself to see to Percy, leaving me sitting like a boulder displacing a stream in the midst of all these people who speak a language I don't understand, and live a life I understand even less. After a time, Ernesta comes and sits beside me. Her joints crack as she moves.
"Would you like me to read for you?"
I don't understand what she's asking, until she slides a deck of tarot cards from a velvet bag slung at her hip. I almost laugh. "Don't take this wrong," I say. "But I think all that tarot, tea leaves, what have you, is nonsense." She shuffles the cards, and they make a sound like wind slithering through tall grass.
"That does not answer my question."
She holds out the deck, and it feels like an invitation I can't turn away, the calling card of a traveler far from home. Against my better judgment, I take the deck.
"Shuffle,"
she instructs, and I do, with significantly less grace than she. Then return them. She fans the cards on the ground between us.
"Choose your first."
I make a show of letting my fingers walk over the cards like they're a pathway. To my great surprise, a warm hum quavers in my fingertips and I stop, without quite knowing why, and touch one.
"Five cards," she prompts,
and I select the rest of my set. Ernesta eases them ahead of the others.
"The first is a representation of you," she explains as she flips it. "The King of Cups. Emotional balance, stability, and generosity."
That sounds quite good, until she pins on,
"But as you've drawn it upside down, you are the inverse.
emotional and volatile, a man whose heart rules his life, confusion in love and relationships, a lack of control and balance.
Which is less good? She flips the second card, which is thankfully right side up, so there's no chance of her pulling that bait and switch again.
The Four of Cups, she says. A dissatisfaction with life.
She turns the next and clicks her tongue.
So many cups.
What does that mean? I ask, a bit more anxious than I mean to sound.
Cups are the suit of passion and love. The heart suit. Here, the Eight of Cups means leaving things behind. The heavy things that cling to us and weigh us down. But we grow accustomed to familiar weights and cannot let them go.
Ernesta turns the next card over. The lantern light jumps, glancing off the sketch of a skeletal head, upside down.
Death reversed, she says.
In spite of not believing in any of this, I've gotten rather wrapped up in it, and seeing that staring back at me is downright spooky. Does that mean...
You're not going to die,
she says, like she read my mind, though I suppose it's a common question when the spectre is flipped.
Death reversed is a transformation, a new life, or a new view on the one you have.
She peels my last card from the deck without looking at it, and sets it so it overlaps with the King of Cups. The King of Wands. The two drawings seem to look at each other, their eyes turned inward. She doesn't explain the second king, just stares at the pair with a scrutiny that deepens the wrinkles in her forehead.
In the East, she says after a time, her gaze still downcast, there is a tradition known as Kintsukuroi. It is the practice of mending broken ceramic pottery using lacquer, dusted with gold and silver and other precious metals. It is meant to symbolize that things can be more beautiful for having been broken.
Why are you telling me this? I ask. At last she looks up at me. Her iris is a polished obsidian in the moonlight.
Because I want you to know, she says, that there is life after survival.
I don't know what to say to that. My throat feels suddenly swollen, so I simply nod. Ernesta gathers up her cards and leaves me alone to mull the reading, while I drink some sharp-edged spirits Pascal gave me that's so acidic it's likely meant to be medicinal. I tip my head back against the railing and look up at the stars. A firefly drifts from the bank of the river and lands on my knee, throbbing golden like it fell from the sky. Someone sits beside me, and when I look over, there's Percy, his shoulder right up against mine. He pulls his knees up to his chest, a little stiff, like he's still hurting, then glances over at me with his chin tucked. His lashes cast spiderwebs upon his cheeks. How are you feeling? I ask, before the silence has a chance to turn uncomfortable or I say something infinitely stupider. One of his hands strays absently to the spot on his arm where the fleam went in for the bloodletting.
Better.
Good, that's... good. My own hand slips into my pocket and closes around the alchemical puzzle box. The dials shuffle beneath my fingertips. I don't want to fight with you. He looks over at me.
I don't want you to fight with me either.
I laugh, a short, sincere burst that catches even me off guard, and the moment feels so adjacent to ordinary that I loosen. Or maybe that's the spirits, though I haven't had much. I hold the bottle out to him. Do you want a drink? He shakes his head. I take another swallow for courage, but all I can think of is Percy is ill, Percy is going to an asylum at the end of this tour, and he didn't trust you enough to tell you so. I think we should go to Barcelona, I say before I've really thought it out.
You want to return the box?
Well, yes, but I was thinking about what Felicity said, and the grandmother's, about Mateu Robles. If he does work with alchemy and healing and... whatever that other word was?
Panacea.
Yes, that. He's there before I have to explain the rest of my reasoning. I've tried alchemical treatments before. What if this is different? He may be able to cure you. I think it's daft not to try, at least.
Monty, I've been promised so many cures by so many doctors, but if you can find a way to be rid of your... illness, you won't have to go to Holland. You can come home with me.
We can go back. He scrapes at his bottom lip with his teeth, staring up at the stars, and I can't fathom why he isn't meeting me with an enthusiastic, yes, 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 let's go to Barcelona